This is Sounds of the Bazaar, live internet radio, broadcasting from Online Educa 2013 in Berlin. And I'm Jenny Hughes. I'm presenting the program this morning with my co-presenter from Radioactive, Andreas Auschwarzer. Andreas?
Good morning, everybody. We hope we will present you a wonderful program. But you must know it's stormy outside in Berlin, and it's a lot of snow coming down, and a lot of wind, too. So I hope you will feel all comfortable here in the Intercontinental Hotel.
And I'm very glad I'm inside. It is blowing a blizzard outside. The atmosphere at the Intercontinental this morning is kind of subdued, and I guess it's because some people have actually gone, but I'm really hoping that our speakers this morning are going to be here. We've got a great lineup. We've got Deborah Arnold talking about learning journeys, Ali Abarish talking about culture and technology, and we've got somebody talking about data mining, the e-learning toolbox, about MOOCs, and a whole host of other things. So my first guest this morning, who's actually sitting down, so I need to get him up out of his chair. Ali, can you stand up? This is going to be technologically really difficult because Ali has to be the tallest person here, and I'm positively the shortest person here. So we're going to give this a go. Ali, I talked to you yesterday. Really like to talk to you this morning again about some of the things we discussed.
Okay.
So let's start with, when we chatted yesterday, I was so impressed by your exhibition because, as ever, you have the biggest, bestest stand in the whole of Online Educa. And when I talked to you about why you've done all this, you said to me that, for you, the integration of technology and culture was really, really important. So do you want to tell me more about that?
Okay. In fact, you cannot separate education from so other fields and discipline beside it. And cultural studies now prove that if you connect learning to your own culture, the students will kind of have the same environment, and which the blending of both will enhance their acquisition of topic contents, and they help them also to long life learning in retention and all those kind of things. So we are not just taking technology as is, but we are utilizing technology to suit our own needs and to enrich learning and the acquisition of knowledge by students, especially young ones.
Okay, yesterday we discussed the fact that so many people are concerned about the integration of technology with the pedagogy. You're adding this third dimension, the cultural dimension. Can you give us some examples of how it actually works in your country?
Okay. Now, as I said before, we cannot separate different elements. When we talk about learning is a kind of a big thing. It integrates so many other things: behavior, pedagogy, culture, religion, politics. Everything is connected to learning. But it differs on how the ratio between things. It depends on your subject matter. For example, if you are teaching political science, you have to understand the mentality of the people. So you have to go back and study their culture. If you are studying literature, it is the same thing. Without knowing the culture itself, you are not going to understand people, because knowledge itself is understanding your other human brother and sister around you.
So can you tell us a story about some of the things you've actually been doing, some of the projects, some of the initiatives you've put into place in Saudi Arabia?
Okay, now, the growth of the young generation in Saudi Arabia is tremendous. And with the evolution of technology, young kids now, they can play with technology better than their teachers. So we have to make this kind of balance between teachers who are the old generation, people who are not tech savvy, and this generation, and bring them together and trying to melt the cultural ideas, cultural beliefs, cultural attitudes within this kind of melting pot, where we can get the best outcomes for both, for our teachers who are going to continue teaching our kids, and to bring up this generation with an understanding how to utilize technology, not how to abuse technology, to enhance their learning.
Do you know one of the best things about Educa over the years? Because I remember 6-7 years ago when it was almost entirely Western European and American. Now it's absolutely marvelous to see more Middle Eastern countries, more Far Eastern countries, more African countries. What are we going to learn from your experiences in Saudi Arabia?
Well, actually, education in general, it stands on exchange of ideas, exchange of experiences. Being here, actually, we are learning things, and we are transferring our own experiences to others. A lot of people who came to our stand, we talked about this. They have seen our approaches to e-learning. We're not different. We are trying to complete the whole image of how e-learning and how technology should enhance and enrich a learning experience for the learners.
That's absolutely brilliant. Now, I've got one request, okay? Just one request before I let you go.
Sure.
I want to dress up in one of your robes on your stand. Can I do that later?
You can come anytime as long as we are here.
That sounds brilliant. All right. Ali, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Still spend 4 hours in the record bin. If my man's in, I guess I'll crank it up. I guess I gotta score two more. If I have any luck, police be fucking with me, cause I'm a middle-aged with a tube rapper, first box of delay and a phaser, shutting down the bosses of bank, it's understood. If rock and roll up, we ain't up from neighborhood. No,
yeah, next guest and speaker in front of me is Jilly Salmon, who is one of the keynote speakers here at the Online Etica. You're from Australia. Let's talk about PLEs at the first. What's your most important point of personal learning environments you want to stream out to our listeners?
Okay. Well, we joined up with a number of people who are actively doing public-private partnerships yesterday. To look at the most difficult thing, the way we looked at it was universities have been islands until now. For many hundreds of years, they've always looked inwards, believing that they are the font of all knowledge. And now in an area where we want growth and partnership, we join together with those who are successfully working with universities and private companies together.
Okay, and it all ends with the money, and we now have a big trend. It's called open, and it's called open educational resources and activities and courses. So tell about what's your in Australia, your vision on it.
Well, there's a personal vision, which is a little bit different from maybe the government vision, but we believe that big data is now available to open up education for everyone. And that if we're using government money for research, we should be openly publishing our results.
Okay. So who do you think, if you think about your students, what should they benefit on the openness?
Right. The benefit for students on openness is that they can be self-discoverers. They don't have to depend on professors like me to tell them what they should learn.
Okay. And how does it look like?
Well, to me, it looks very much not like an island. It looks like a landscape. The way we're viewing it is university as the port to which students can relate, but they don't have to physically come.
Okay. You talked about the private-public partnerships and taking ownerships, and I would say it's also an expression of private citizenship in somehow. How could companies benefit from those approaches?
Well, the way of benefiting the approaches is that universities do understand about learning, and they do have the knowledge, and it's both tacit and objective knowledge that's been developed. But companies have the agility and the way of relating to students as customers. So the two different missions and visions, but joined together, they're world beating.
Okay. Having such a closed tower like the universities are, what are your visions and strategies to bring all the experience outside the world back to the science and to the universities?
I don't know that we're bringing it back. I think it's both exporting learning and importing students. So it's much more of a network these days, like the digital world.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
And it's back to me again, and I'm talking to Michael Moore, who's come over from Florida all the way to Berlin from a company called...
Desire to Learn.
And can you tell us what Desire to Learn is all about? I know you mentioned data mining, which is frightening me to death, but do you want to explain simply for people like me what that is all about?
Sure. So Desire to Learn is actually an integrated learning platform, but one of our components is a data warehouse. And data mining really is simply the ability to go in and dig through the data, not like digging in the ground, but kind of similar. So we're looking into historical learning behavior and learning activities of students, and then making predicted analytics or predicted recommendations or predicted choices based on that activity, based on that history.
Okay, so I'm a teacher.
Okay.
So what's it going to mean to me? What do I do?
Well, the great value that it means to you as a teacher is you have the ability to know where, how your students are performing in a real time. So if you, let's say you teach a large class of 1,200 students, right? It's virtually impossible for one instructor to have a personalized relationship with every one of those 1,200 students. However, using data mining techniques and some data analysis, you can easily identify students that are potentially struggling or having a hard time, and you can personalize their learning journey. So it's almost as if they're receiving personalized one-on-one attention when they're really in the large group.
So is this different? I mean, this sounds really dull, but is this different from sort of normal learning management systems?
It is a bit different. We are a fully integrated learning platform, so we bring in a whole bunch of different capabilities, fully integrated and tightly integrated in one place. And all of our data is integrated with the daily activities of the students. So there's no duplication of effort for the students. There's no duplication of effort for the instructors. We're leveraging those activities that take place on a normal basis already.
And is this just for managing students and courses, or does it actually hold content as well?
Oh, yeah. No, it definitely holds content, provides all the traditional learning management system capabilities. You can have content and quizzes and Dropboxes and all of that kind of stuff, as well as other things like e-portfolios. And we have mobile applications and webcasting and lots of other features as well.
I was just going to ask you one more question, okay, which is about a sort of security thing. The students can access their own data, but can they also export that data to take with them if they move to another college, another university, another school?
So one of our products, which is called our ePortfolio, provides a lifelong learning capability so that students can take their ePortfolio with them forever at no cost to them and no cost to the institution. So that way the students really do own their learning and they take it with them. So if they do move from institution to institution, they can certainly do that. Plus, they can also take it and create digital resumes and portraits of their learning journey and evidence of their learning.
Okay, my last question. If people want to find you to talk about analytics and data mining in education, where do they look?
Here at the conference, we're right down the hall, Desire to Learn booth. Online, it would be desiretolearn2.com.
Michael, thank you very much. I hope you get back to Florida in this weather. And now it's back over to Andreas.
Hi, everybody. I'm now in front of Markus Rieke from iVersity Germany, and everybody in Germany in the high school sector or university sector knows now iVersity because they started a big approach about MOOCs, and they started a combat and a competition about who will present the best MOOC. Tell me about your vision of massive open online courses.
Yeah, iVersity launched about 15th of October, what's that, eight weeks ago. And we launched with 25 MOOCs and a little over 100,000 students. Today we're at over 250,000, 260,000 students. And our vision was, when we started out to do this, that we wanted to use 2013 to establish ourselves as the leading MOOC platform in Europe with a robust curriculum of online courses, which we believe we have, and a sufficient number of students so that we would be seen as being sufficiently massive, because we are talking about the massive open online courses. And we managed to do that too at 260,000 students after just 2 months of being live. And some of our biggest and most popular courses, which some of you may have heard about, would be The Future of Storytelling, which has about 80,000 students, or Design 101, which has about 30,000 students. So we think that MOOCs are very much the catalyst driving the digital revolution in higher education. And that was a phenomenon that was, of course, hugely in the press and in discussion in the US, in the Anglo-American world, but it's now definitely arrived in Europe.
Okay, let's go back to the word. And you are emphasizing the massive part. What's the open part? What's your criteria and your spirit behind the open?
I think it's identical in spirit to how the openness of MOOCs was intended in the U.S., which is neither do you have to pay to participate in the class, so they are free, and secondly, you also don't have to provide any sort of prerequisites, any pre-qualifications. That's really the revolutionary nature of a university course as in the model of a MOOC, because in many countries in the world, to attend a university, you have to pass an entrance exam for a course, and in many cases, not in Germany, but in many other countries, you have to also pay a tuition fee. Neither is true for MOOCs. So they are genuinely open to anyone and everyone who has an interest in trying it out.
Okay. MOOCs can be a marketing element for universities and companies also. But I want to go back to the learner and ask why MOOCs could be a benefit for learning and the design of learning for everybody.
I think I think it's fairly obvious when you consider that before, you know, this whole phenomenon erupted some 2 years ago, basically, that university level courses at the course level, not at the degree level, were suddenly being offered online, and that for learners globally is a complete transformation of how university level content was accessible. Prior to MOOCs, you used to have to go to a physical university. Now, at the click of a button, you can access a Harvard class or our storytelling class for free any time of the day. So all of a sudden, through the digital revolution that MOOCs represent, university-level learning is accessible to anyone with a broadband connection, regardless of whether they sit in Berlin or Bombay.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm now handing over to Jen again. Who has the next guest in the line?
I'm going to be talking to Jeremy Rudy. Jeremy Rudy is from Pearson's, who are the platinum sponsors yet again for Online Educa 2013. Jeremy, thank you very much to Pearson's for supporting this event. How far have you come?
I'm actually from our Denver, Colorado office. It's one of our regional technology hubs within Pearson, where we work on a lot of our learning platforms that are used around the world.
So I'm really curious, just why did Pearson's put so much effort and time and energy and money into Educa?
Well, that's a great question. I think it's a wonderful conference. It's been going on for a number of years. It's, for us, it's a way to bring together a lot of the ecosystem in education technology, as well as just a lot of the partners, the schools, the countries that are deeply involved in online education. And we see it as a great conference that we want to continue to support.
Pearson's are involved in so many aspects of education. I'd like to say a finger in every pie, but that sounds kind of derogatory and it's not meant to be. But you're involved in private universities, you're involved in e-learning, you're involved in apprenticeship training. So much is going on for Pearson's. So where are your priorities now?
Oh, that's a great question. You're right. There is multiple priorities, lots of different lines of business in different geographies. I think what we've seen in the last year is a much greater focus coming together with our new CEO, John Fallon. And I think more than anything, no matter which line of business, no matter which geography, it's all being focused now around efficacy. And our efficacy framework, which we've launched and which we've shared through the packet, the book that's been given out to participants here, is really a framework for us to focus around learning outcomes and how all of our products, our services, our partnerships are lined up towards improving educational outcomes. Particularly what I work on is OpenClass. That's our free open learning platform, and we focus a lot around mobile. So how can our learning platform, whether we're working with the school, an education technology partner, or the students and instructors themselves, how are we improving those educational outcomes through the efficacy framework? So I think you'll see that as a big part of what we're doing in this coming year, measuring our results through efficacy, whether it's with the private schools, whether it's with textbooks, whether it's with or just direct-to-consumer products like our Global English, is all focused around efficacy.
How do you see this partnership between private sector and public sector working? Is this a model for the future, or is there going to be open competition?
Oh, great question.
Sorry, didn't mean to put you on the spot there.
Yeah, and I don't know if I'm the best to answer that. I think I gave a talk yesterday that was focused around these innovative models that we're starting to see both in K-12 and higher ed, and I think we don't know what's going to be the best model yet. And so the right mixture between private and public, it's all an open game or an open field. And I think, yeah, that handbook is yet to be written. And we're seeing a lot of great experimentation. Pearson, through our Affordable Learning Fund, is investing in a lot of different models from Bridge Academy and Omega Schools in Africa, projects in India and Bangladesh. We're obviously experimenting ourselves with private schools in China and South Africa. And so what works best, I think, is yet to be determined. And I think we're trying to just support different models of innovation and then measuring what works.
One last question, Jeremy, and you may not want to answer this. What's the latest secrets from Pearson's? What are you experimenting with? What's going to be on the drawing boards? What's going to come out next year? Can you tell us?
Oh, there is some very cool projects being worked on and some that I'm aware of that I probably can't speak on publicly. I think more than anything is we're seeing some great technology companies pave the way for us, both in terms of devices, in terms of bandwidth. So what Google and Microsoft and Apple are doing with devices is extraordinary. And Pearson's going to try to ride that wave as much as possible and take advantage of that innovation. I think what you'll start to see much more is much more mobile-first thinking, mobile-first programs, and fully offline support with different initiatives through mobile devices. And beyond that, I think you'll just have to see with what's coming. And it's going to be an exciting year and a lot of different things coming out from Pearson and as well as other education companies. So you just have to wait and see.
Well, I'll talk to you again next year. Maybe you can tell me then. Jeremy, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Okay, and now it's going beach by beach. We have Heike Philipp, and I want to tell you, Heike Philipp, I know, because we met together in the first MOOC in the educational sector driven by George Simmons and Stephen Downs and Rod Lucia, who was moderating. And since then, we always flipped around and all over networks we're using, and we met the first time here, and she told me about a new project. And she's an expert in language learning. She has her own company in language learning and supporting language learning. And she's now a 3-year project. And tell me about what's the key?
Well, we just started it. It's a new EU-funded project on the topic of producing 3D animated videos for language learning in virtual worlds. They're called Machinima. And last year at this time, I presented about Machinima in what we now know, the second edition of Video Educa. And at that time, I asked all of these video experts, have you ever heard of Machinima? And they said, no. Well, I said, look up the YouTube channel with 4 billion view clicks and 8.3 million subscribers. Machinima is about, for language educators, a wonderful opportunity to not only produce their own e-learning material, but also to have the learners produce their own videos.
Coming back to the learners and the learning, how do they learn? What's the benefit on using 3D worlds for learning?
Well, my vision is that even like in the corporate sector, what we're seeing at the moment already, which is a lot of web conferences, webinars, or presentations online taking place, meetings, in virtual meetings in company, and the employees are not prepared for this kind of medium. They don't know how to present online.
They are not trained by the vocabulary. They are forced to use it immediately, what they know.
Yeah, and worse still, all of these meetings are being recorded. So if you say something wrong. So in corporate language learning, I can see that expertise at a distance, which I developed in 2005, happening at the moment really in need of language teachers who know how to use web conferencing solutions for language teaching in order to tell their learners how to do it.
Okay, tell our listeners about the big barriers you're overcoming.
Well, the big barriers is really the language educator himself, his adversity against it technology. It's now breaking off slowly, slowly, but the typical language teacher still focuses on productive skills in a classroom. That means he is interested in having the students speak in front of him, but what he does not focus on is that amount of communication that takes place online, which is email, texting, real-life chat like on Skype, etc. Especially texting is a big, big issue that's never been addressed by language schools.
Okay. What do you think a new generation language teacher or trainer or facilitator, what should he bring with it?
Well, imagine you would like to learn Spanish and you're in business, you don't have time, you travel a lot. Your language educator will be in Madrid and you will connect to him via Skype, via Adobe Connect, via Blackboard Collaborate, via Virtual Worlds, wherever the medium takes you. And then you can enjoy language lessons at a distance in real time. That is my expertise, my background, and I hope I'm looking forward to this becoming more apparent.
Hope we have to clone you a lot. Handing over to Hannah and to Jan again.
I'm talking to Deborah Arnold. Debs, it's brilliant to see you again. This has got to be about the seventh year running. So this is kind of a chat because I want to catch up with the gossip, find out what you've been doing over the last year. I know it's something to do with learning journeys.
Yeah, I've been in the new job now for 2 years, in fact. It's all gone very, very fast. I see it really as a learning journey of me coming into managing a department within a university after managing projects and realizing that managing departments, managing people in a department and managing projects are not the same thing, although there's skills and approaches that I can draw on in doing that, but the challenges are really, really something else.
So what have been the biggest differences? You've moved back into academia, into higher education, to university, and it's all different. So what are the differences?
The differences are actually being within an institution and working alongside the institutional objectives rather than those objectives that we set for individual projects. But that's really nice because it's helping to take something which is perhaps expressed in a very general way and to make it reality and make sure that the processes, the people, the competences are there within and that the dialogue is there within the institution. I think that's been one of the biggest things that we've been working on, is making sure that as our department, which is the EdTech and learning distance learning department, that we're not just seen as the techies, that we're actually in dialogue with the academics who are supporting us, helping us point things in the right direction.
So what are you actually doing? Learning journeys. I know the words, and I also know that you've got a session this afternoon. For those people who are not going to make it, and I'm hoping I'm actually going to be there, do you want to give us the highlights?
Well, the highlights are also some of the things that I saw at the ICDE SCOP last week in Lisbon, where we had a great keynote from Tony Bates as well, who's always been an inspiration to me. So a few things coming from there, a few challenges. I've even got Grumpy Cat in my presentation slides, if that's just to illustrate some of the challenges that we're facing as well within the institution and in higher education in general. I don't think we're the only ones from the conversations that I've been having. So
what for you is a learning journey? I know it's something we bandy around, but everybody's got a completely different take on this. What do you mean by a learning journey?
Right, well, my take on it is really my own personal learning journey, coming into a new job, having to draw on all my prior experience, following formal training courses, informal learning, and bringing all that together to apply it in concrete terms. So just to give a couple of examples, I followed a quality training course on how to introduce quality into an EdTech department. I followed a course on managing your emotions in professional contexts, a course on management practices, and really pulling all that together and taking out of that. I also followed a couple of MOOCs as well, never right through to the end. I'm one of the dropouts, but going back as well into those MOOCs, which still have their resources available, and using it as a toolbox, going in and saying, oh, I can use this, I can apply this, talking to people, and really drawing it all together. So that's my vision of a learning journey, and I think that's what it should also be for our students and our learners all their lives.
So in your departments, what are you actually doing to support learners' learning journeys?
What are we doing? Well, we're putting together courses, but we're also talking to the academics and trying to get them to rethink as well their teaching and learning activities. Talking to them, drawing out their ideas, maybe trying to nudge them in the direction of more active learning, when the traditional model, as you know, as most of us know, in higher education is very much the front on, face-to-face. And when you put that in the context of distance learning, bring in project-based learning as well, you know, very concrete actions. Nice example that I like to quote is our latest course. I'm doing a bit of a plug here, but our latest course on wine culture and wine tourism. Of course, we're the University of Burgundy, so we have to do a distance.
I want to enroll now.
No, but we do it. We want to do it in English because we've got so much demand for it as well. And then one of the things that, but it's actually not a total distance learning course, because there's one thing that you can't do at a distance, and that's wine tasting. And so we haven't found the technology to do it, and nobody wants to find the technology to be able to do it distance-wise. You know, it's one of those moments when you get together around a nice glass of wine. And
that sounds brilliant, and I really want to be there. I'm going to join this course. Where is the university based? Where's your department based? Sorry, one last question.
Well, we're in Dijon, so it's the capital of Burgundy, but the university has sites all over the region as well. So
I know the region quite well, so I'm going to be there. Okay, Debbie, can I just say, this afternoon, one plug, the name of your session this afternoon, and do you know where it is?
I know where it is. It's in Schinkel. It's at 4:30 to 5:30, so just before everybody gets together in the Marlene Bar for drinks, come along to the session. There's also Julian, I can't remember his surname, from the Royal Agricultural University, who's presenting. We've got Claudio Dondi chairing our session, so we think we're going to have a nice one.
Debbie, thanks very much indeed. I'm sure I'll see you next year. And lots of love to your gorgeous husband. Am I allowed to say that online?
I'll tell him.
Thank you.
Okay. The next guest is Anja Lorenz. And she's from the Chemnitz University of Technology. And is talking, and they have a stand here because they have a spin-off on activity on project. And tell us about it.
Yes, it's a project of the Chemedia of the Chemedia AG, and they are publishing a platform for open educational resources. So it's an authoring platform they also use for commercial purposes, but this one is for building content and register for free. And the condition is that you put your content you're creating in there, putting under a Creative Commons license, and so put it for free to the other users.
Okay, so openness is deeply embedded in this approach, and it's one of the missing parts because it's an authoring toolbox. So if you want to know more about it, you must test the receipt of the ginger ale. But what's your story behind? What target group you are aiming to?
At first it was built for universities and schools, I think, because there's often low budget for such tools. And on the other hand, Chemedia says that they are using open source tools, they are using knowledge from the community, and they want to give something back. And it's also a hook into the system, and to be a player on the market among Udacity and Coursera and edX and something like that, just to say, okay, we're here in Germany and we also have free and open tools.
Okay. And do somebody is planning to make money off?
Money off?
Of this toolbox?
Yes, I think it's kind of a freemium idea. On the other hand side, it's nice to have it open, and they already have it for enterprises who don't want to have their content open, and maybe someone decides just to join in a closed version. But I think it's not the important one. It's more the important one to be known among the country and the federal state of Saxony, which is very important if you want to make some projects and make some plans with together with universities. They are very excited about that. And at the Chemnitz University of Technology, we are also planning to do some flipped classroom and MOOC solutions with it.
Okay, thank you very much. The next speaker is at the row of Jenny.
My guests are coming fast and furious this morning. Yesterday we were panicking because nobody was here. This morning we've got so many interesting people. This show is going to go on forever. I'm now going to talk to Rina Vorkari. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Exactly. That's very very well. It's a Finnish name, so it's sometimes hard. But let me just tell you what I would like to talk about today. I'm currently working for a research institute which is part of the European Commission, and we are doing a foresight study on open education in 2030.
Is that a kind of the European Commission's crystal ball gazing department? Is that what it's all about?
Well, yes, in a way, if you wish so. Our goal is to do research, evidence-based research, to help actually people in the European Commission to make informed decisions. So, yes, we do not actually use crystal ball, if you wish, but foresight studies, which is it's not a formal method. It's more like a collaborative effort to work with experts in the field, looking at the trends, and then trying to extrapolate what will be happening in the future. There is always a bit of imagination in that game, because of course we cannot understand. But the idea of future studies is really to give a tool for everybody to think, what kind of future do I want in 2030? In this case, it is about education, opening up education. So how do we open it up? What is our aimed goal, and how do we get there? The idea of creating a roadmap, for example, is very, very important in order to give policymakers more tools to make those choices.
So those are some of the questions you're asking yourself, like how do we open up education but make it more accessible? Lots of questions, but have you come up with any answers? What do you really think is going to happen in 2030?
Well, currently, if we are, in order to look in the future, we always look a little bit in the back. And if you think of the history of open education, there are different strands. More importantly, last years, we've been talking about MOOCs and giving access, lowering entry barriers and all that, but that is not all what opening up education is about. There's also the content side, but more importantly, we are thinking also of pedagogy and the idea that the learners should be more self-directed, autonomous in their learning processes. In the future, what do we know? Learning will still be taking place in schools. We are not saying that schools or educational institutions would disappear in 17 years from now, but there will be also other ways of learning. And what we think is very important is that idea what MOOCs have brought along about unbundling education, so that you could take a coursework, use, for example, open educational resources, or you use a MOOC, you learn something. But importantly, you also get certified for that. So certification in the future will not really only be after a seed time, after a course that you paid for an institution, that you get a diploma. But we will be making it happen together, so that we will have also policymakers backing up these ideas of accreditation, prior acknowledging prior skills, for example, learning taking place in informal places. How can we make sure that a learner can also get diploma and be functioning in a society in a way that we wish in the future everybody has a chance? So education in 2030 will not have any dead ends, if you wish so.
And one of the things I'm curious about, I was reading a policy paper. Funny enough, somebody does actually read European policy papers. And yeah, not many of us, but we do. And I was reading this one paper which said the focus was on lifelong learning and developing the autonomous learner. And then three paragraphs later, it said the focus is on collaborative learning and working together. I mean, how do you reconcile that dichotomy?
Well, one thing is that we know learning hardly ever takes place in a space without other people. So you can still be, you can still be autonomous learner and seek for a peer group, for example, to learn with. You seek a collaborative project where you have the learning goals already in mind, and to achieve those goals, you work with somebody else, you collaborate. So you can, those two are not excluding one and the other. And of course, what is also important, what we wish to achieve in by 2030 is that there's a variety of different learning methods. Collaborative learning is just one way of learning, and there are other as good ways of learning too. Reading a book is sometimes the best way to learn. Going to a lecture is very can be very good. Can be maybe the learning itself doesn't happen during the lecture, but afterwards when you're reflecting upon what you were learning, when you're doing some of the homework and so on. So the idea is that there will be many different ways to learn, and they all will be equally important. We don't want to put value on one learning or the other.
Rina, we're going to have to go now because we've got another speaker. The only bit of crystal ball gazing I'd like somebody else in the commission to do is, can they tell us when the new call for Erasmus for All is going to come out? So that would be a useful bit of future planning. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. If you just wait until beginning of, well, even mid December there will be guidelines coming out, so it's not that far away.
Thank you very much.
The next speaker in the row is Carlos Delgado Clos from University of Madrid in Spain. And MOOCs are very prominent at the moment. So tell me your vision of the MOOCs you're representing.
Okay, I think when technology advances and technology is ripe for doing things, new possibilities arise, in particular in education. The MOOCs phenomenon has shown that it's possible to extend the reach of education outside of your institutions towards the world. And this is an important phenomenon, and this is a good advance. But it's not the only one. Technology allows, as it's, we know it now, with interactive videos, with interactive exercises, with hints, with automatic grading, allows many more possibilities. And I think everybody is still experimenting what are all these possibilities. In my view, one important thing is the MOOCs, but there are other important things such as the what everybody calls the SPOCs, the small private online courses. So it's not a massive, it's small, it's not open, it's private, but it can allow to use technology to improve the education on campus. So education on campus is not perfect. Not all the students get in the expected time the maximum mark and finish just on time. So there are things to improve. And I think this technology, MOOC technology if you wish, or MOOC-related technology, can be used to get better student outcomes.
How would this look like?
Well, I can tell you an experiment we have been doing for the last 2 years at my university, the Carlos III University in Madrid. We have taken the Khan Academy platform, which is an excellent platform. It was open source until August 2012. We took it before, integrated it with the Moodle, and we had students use this platform with our own content. Content, for instance, defined or made by the physics professor. So videos, theoretical, practical videos on physics, exercise on physics, and we use this in what we call the zero courses, which are remedial courses for freshmen, in order to refresh the contents in physics and mathematics and chemistry. And they have been looking at it during the month of August, and then there was, what was already before, the face-to-face part. And this face-to-face part was much better after the student had been looking at the videos, doing the exercises during the summer. So this boosted and improved education in one particular aspect. This is for leveling the knowledge of the students which come to university.
Okay. Another question is, MOOCs offer a potential of global dimension. And I got whispered, that's also a thing of your heart, to teach or brings a global dimension of the internet in your courses. So what's your vision on this?
Well, as I said, the advantage of using the same technology both for MOOCs to extend the reach and for SPOCs for improving the education has the advantage that you can, the same content you use in different ways. And this is a big advantage because you have to be clear. It is a cost to produce high quality material. It is a barrier to overcome, to convince professors now that they have to sit down and prepare very good material. So the more you can reuse this content, the better use you make of this time and effort of professors.
Okay, thank you. The next speaker is in the row, so I think we will hand over to Jen again.
I know, it's exhausting this morning, it's brilliant. I'm talking to Philip Geenens, who I think is our third person, which says a lot about delivering language training using e-learning technologies. I'm really fascinated because you're saying that you've got a completely different take on language learning using videos and films. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. When we started 2006, we basically thought of the best method to learn a language or to teach a language. And we found out that video is very powerful because you not only get the language, you basically see the speaker, the native speaker, and you see their behavior and you see the surroundings. You can show more of the country and the culture and use music and food and stuff like that. And that's what it's about. If you talk about language learning, we want to communicate, we want to have fun. and we want to commute with, we want to learn more about other cultures. So why not show it during teaching and learning languages?
So what does that mean for me? I always ask this question. I speak a couple of languages, but I've been a failed German learner for about 3 years. So what do I do to start with?
You start immersing yourself into the German language and the German culture. And there's no discussion that the best way to learn a language is go to the country, go to Germany, spend there 6 months, 12 months, don't speak English, speak German, read German. But few people have the time or the money to spend such a time, a stay in Germany. So we bring the language to you, to your home, to your workplace. We shoot videos with native speakers, with professional actors, and they show you situations of daily life, either general language or business language, business situations. And so basically you can immerse yourself, you can watch the video, you can watch it once, twice, at your own pace, at your own speed, when you want, where you want, and then you immerse yourself into that language, into that situation. And thus you learn with very entertaining video, you learn the language faster and easier.
So can I choose which films I watch, or are they kind of pre-programmed for me?
No, actually they are pre-programmed, pre-produced, but we have more than 200 different situations where you basically can choose freely. So you're flexible to choose either introducing yourself, asking for directions, ordering in a restaurant, or with a business setting, phone calls, negotiation, or scheduling appointments. And the whole platform is very, very modular at linguatv.com, so you can really learn at your own pace.
I'm going to just ask this question, which I think I asked somebody yesterday, more or less. We've got all sorts of technology now, like Google Translate. We're talking about automatic speech synthesizers that are being developed. Why do I need to learn another language anyway?
No, because Google Translate is fine for translating text, but all about, let's say, human life is communicating. And you're communicating in your native language without thinking much with your peers, with your friends, with your colleagues. So why not, in a global world, communicate with others? And of course, English is a very predominant language, but in order to understand about other people's culture and country, it's good to understand them and to know about their foreign language. So of course, you can't speak or learn the 5,000 or 5,500 languages that are out there, but at least some of the important languages or the languages you're interested in order to learn more about it. And this is something that Google Translate, even it's good, but can't deliver.
I think I'm just waiting for the Babel fish that I can stick in my ear or something. Philip, thank you very much for talking to us. We're nearly at the end of our program now. I think one thing I really want to do, because I promised I'd do it, can I go and talk to the girls on the reception desk, Dirk? Okay, I have to go and do this. I'm walking down now towards the reception desk, and I'm going to try and capture the girls down here. Okay, live internet radio, can we talk to you for 2 minutes? We did check this out with your boss, so it's fine. Can you tell me your name?
Marta. Sorry? Marta.
And Marta, where'd you come from?
I'm from Poland.
I think I need to get a bit closer. Can I actually come in there? I don't know whether I can actually reach over this desk. Yes, I can. I'm actually about to reach. Who am I talking to now?
Sorry?
Can I have your name?
My name is Ayman.
And you're working on the information desk here at Educare. How many of you are here?
I'm here since the first day of this event, and I'm working the desk of my OUB, the application.
So how many languages do people speak here? Do you know?
All of the languages? Or do you mean the people who work here? I don't know.
How many languages do you speak yourself?
Just German and English.
And you speak?
I speak French, English, a bit German, Arabic, and a bit Polish.
Wow, so that's about six. Okay. Do you have any strange requests that people have asked you about over the last few days?
No, at all.
What do most people come and ask you?
About the application, and mostly about to help them about directions and everything.
Okay, I'm going to go back to Dirk because he's going to shout at me otherwise because we have to finish this program. But it's really nice to see some of the people who work backstage at Educare to make this all happen. Thank you very much to you and your team. Right, let's get back to Dirk because we do have to finish. He's making noises. I think he's suggesting that he wants to go and have a cup of coffee, so we need to finish now. So this is Sounds of the Bazaar, live internet radio from Online Educa. And before we leave, I'd like to say thank you very much to the team. Thank you very much to Andreas, the Radioactive team, to Owen, who's been running around getting coffee and people organized. And a big thanks to Dirk Stieglitz on the mixing desk, who's made it all happen. And it's thanks from me, Jenny Hughes, at Online Educa 2013. So this is Sounds of the Bazaar, live, Online Educa, going offline. See you again next year, folks.